Natural Living with Gary Null, exploring the nature and politics of medicine, health, nutrition, and the environment. And now your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Today on our program, we're going to be doing something a little different. I normally have either commentaries on important issues or guests sharing insights, but instead I'm going to use today's program as an opportunity to show you all the different things that are happening that do connect with us, that do not get the type of mainstream media coverage I believe they should, and at the same time be able to give you some insights or commentary on each of these particular topics when appropriate. Some of the topics stand alone as them for themselves. I'll be giving the quotes and citations for those of you who would like that information. I was once coming off the air when I was doing a show on WBAI, and as I'm walking out of the studio, a woman was sitting there, and she says, I came down here, I was in the neighborhood and wanted to sit in and hear your show on health and nutrition, and you were talking about something dealing with pesticides. Well, I'm not interested in that. I'm interested in alternative approaches to disease. I've got arthritis. Stick with what you know. You know, we're not interested in these topics. And I looked at her, I said, well, I can appreciate that you may be interested in something that would affect you directly, but there are people who do see these other issues as being important. And how do you know that your arthritis would not be improved if you switched to an organic diet? She said, oh, it's too much trouble. I said, well, would you be willing to make some fundamental changes like getting off dairy and wheat? She said, there's nothing wrong with dairy and wheat. My parents grew up on dairy and wheat. I said, so what are you looking for exactly? And she said, well, I heard there are certain vitamins that'll help, you know, maybe one or two vitamins. I said, do you think that the reason you developed arthritis is because of a deficiency of a few vitamins? And she looked at me quizzically and she said, well, that's what I think. And I said, but ma'am, that's not the reality of it. We are interconnected with so many different phenomena that occur. And until we take the time and have the patience to step back from all this, we won't appreciate what impact it has. And the very people, the very same institutions, federal and state, city, local, collegiate, special corporate interests that we have relied upon to guide us, when they decide for their own agenda to mislead us or to cover up something, then that also is a part of our health. After all, when we were told to go to fight in Desert Storm, 700,000 Americans signed up for it. And when they went there, they were faced with depleted uranium, experimental vaccines where they were given no informed consent. Also there, they were told that the oil fires would not make a major impact upon their health, and that there was no biological exposures. In point of fact, all of the above happened. Now these people are sick. Many, many have died, and it's infectious in their families. Wives have the same conditions as their husbands. So when they're turning on a radio, hearing a program like this, if I can give them not just insights in how to get well, but also to understand what it is when you misplace your faith, when you trust people who do not deserve it, then if there were another conflict, would they be as interested in going under the same conditions to help again? At least 95% of the people I interviewed for an ongoing series on Gulf War Syndrome said they had no problem with the conflict, how it was fought or their leaders. They just want to get their medical coverage. And I said, well, if these people did not have to have this conflict, if it really wasn't about the lies about babies being bayoneted in a nursery that later turned out to be a complete and total fabrication by someone associated with a major PR firm in the United States that has a history of misguiding on issues that government agencies and corporate interests have used over and over again. If if Kuwait was no better than Iraq, if there was massive racism, white slavery, and it really had to do with oil and the politics of oil and the special interests held to oil, much like Vietnam, would you then see this as a necessary and vital security issue? Or would you see it as a geoeconomic political issue that is best handled diplomatically and not through our intervention? And also, since the end of the war, almost 700,000 Iraqi children have died. They've died from various medical conditions and mass starvation. Is an Iraqi child that knows nothing of politics, knows nothing of Saddam Hussein, but does know that they played with depleted uranium pieces, and now they've died of a rare cancer. Is that important also? And you frequently get back, well, you know, they're part of the enemy. Now, how can a baby be a part of an enemy? When you do that, then it's no different than dropping bombs on Vietnam from an airplane. Well, the enemy's in the village, so if some friendly fire people get killed, so be it. And I look at these kind of mindsets with the type of indifference, callous disregard for the sanctity and sovereignty of life to justify some ideological separation. How many times in human history have people who really had nothing to do with the conflict, didn't start it, were just the victims of it? How many times have we stopped long enough to say, why are we doing this? What is the real purpose of this conflict? And historically, we can look at almost every conflict to see that it could have been stopped at different times. It could have been presented a different way. We could have approached it differently. But we don't. We mass together. We allow people that we have given over the power to make decisions to us. And so whether they're taking us to war or telling us to drink milk, or they're telling us that we need genetically engineered food to save the starving the world, and that we should be rushing in to do something with human cloning, whether it's these same people telling us that fluoride is necessary to protect the teeth of our children, or they're the ones who tell us that we need to have compulsory vaccination, and if you don't apply to the compulsory vaccination, that you are an unfit parent. These are the people who tell us that we don't need to teach reading, writing, arithmetic. We need conflict resolution. We need identity counseling. We need to change the curriculum. When these people tell us that our children are suffering from a mass epidemic disease called attention deficit disorder, to which the pharmaceutical interests have the cure, Ritalin, when they tell us that women are not capable of maintaining emotional stability and therefore shouldn't be trusted with important decisions, exclude them from the vote, and then give them Valium, when they say that no such disease as candida or environmental illness or hypoglycemia exists because they don't have a drug to treat it, but once there is a drug to treat it, suddenly it's the scourge. When I look at authority, I look to see how has the authority honored its pledge to us, and more often than not, it has betrayed it. So that's why this program today is important, and it is connected. We have just to get past our own particular needs and to see that, gee whiz, if someone told me that I needed pesticides and that they were good for me and necessary and not harmful, what else could they do that could also prove harmful? And our major media does not cover these stories. And when they do cover a story, it's never to investigate the truth. It's merely to report the official position. It's kind of interesting, when I was on a PBS station in Boston in December of 1998, I had never been on a PBS station in Boston before, and I went up one day, and that night I went on the air and talked about reversing the aging process, meaning slowing it down and what causes aging. And what they didn't know was I had to have 12 physicians and scientists on the set when I was filming it. And then it had to go through a whole medical vetting process where they had to go over every single statement in my script. And I had to change things to meet their needs. But I was prepared, and I had all the studies, and so it went on the air. A particularly interested, it was a, just blew out all the previous records at every station in America, no matter what the programming. NET in New York, the biggest one in the country, in Chicago and Los Angeles. 27 cities I went to, and 27 straight records fell. Suddenly, I was on the inside of the mainstream cultural acceptance curve. The very same information, identical information, that if someone would have listened to me talk about on my daily non-commercial radio program, they would have had to have rejected it. If they had listened to it, they would have listened but not actualized, because there's a limit on what the mainstream culture allows in the way of challenge or change, unless it's officially sanctioned, unless it's controlled at every level, so that those who are in special places of power can maintain the profitability of whatever is done. Now, that's why you have your main culture and your subculture. But I was neither in the main culture nor the subcultures. I was in the counterculture. Now, you wouldn't know that by the way I dress or the way I treat people. I come from a small southern community and treat people with respect, and very conscientious of my surroundings, and do all I can, as most people do, to help one another coexist. And yet, just because I was talking about something as seemingly non-threatening as putting fiber in the diet, that made me suddenly excluded from any acceptability. That happened 20 years previous on ABC Network when I debated one of the top people at the AMA, and the debate was over fiber. And he very specifically and very explicitly said, fiber is worth nothing except to cows and pigs, and humans just don't need it because it doesn't play any role in our health. As a result, Americans were getting under 2 grams of fiber a day. So colorectal cancer, diverticulitis, constipation was epidemic, but he didn't see this as being a problem, nor did he see milk and dairy as anything other than the benefit to our calcium intake, nor did he see eating meat as being a problem. He felt that was necessary, and that vegetarians were malnourished and sickly and suffering from multiple conditions and would surely shorten the lifespan. Well, of course, all that is absolutely opposite. Vegetarians have 98% less likelihood of developing cancers, the prostate and breasts and uterus. There's over 70% less likelihood of having a heart attack or dying of other causes as compared to meat eating. That we now know that a minimum of 50 grams of fiber a day is necessary. So something as simple as discussing fiber took me from mainstream culture to counterculture. If you're a famous person and you have some, let's say, some differences in your lifestyle, you'll be okay. Like a James Dean or Marlon Brando, even eccentric writers, Upton Sinclair. Providing that you stick with everything else that is of a common value. You can wear your hair any way you want. You can spout off, providing that you're still a Democrat or Republican, you're still eating the same food, or you're still living in the same way. You'll still be in the subculture of the main culture. You're still connected, but you're more like Peck's bad boy. Every family supposedly has a black sheep, but it's still a member of the family. It's still nurtured by the same values. You go too far. You say things that are no longer just differences of a style or opinion, but really threatening to the previous belief systems you grew up with. And now you go from the main culture to the subculture to out. Now you're in the hinterlands. You're in the counterculture. And from there, just by a simple terminology, the way we use words, you no longer have any power to change anything. So now I was back on PBS, or on PBS, and I had gotten by the Guardians of the Gates. And now, people were starting to pay attention. By the tens of millions, they were listening to the message. Now this message, which before, bits and pieces they could have at least accepted, may even have tried at times, now it was just flooding them. And a lot of them were very happy about this because common sense dictated that they should be living a different life as far as their health and nutrition. This had nothing to do with their politics or their religion or their sex, just their lifestyle as far as health and stress and dietary means. In fact, I really focused on diet first time around a lot. So now here we have people making changes. Well, when you're an enormous belief system, you can't watch everything all the time. And if something gets underneath your radar screens, it can stay there for a little bit of time. So I immediately prepared a second special, Get Healthy Now, and a third special for women only. So within a period of 9 months, I had three separate specials on the air. That had never been done before, not by one individual, not within 1 year, not on PBS. All three were successful, though for women only, the show itself was very successful, but we had made a mistake, and I knew at the time we were making a mistake. I knew intuitively we were making a mistake by having some of the feminists on, because where had it been a softer approach on just how women could overcome their endometriosis and PMS and deal with menopause and in a natural way, that would have been more palatable. But we took the full feminist message with Barbara Seaman and others into our virtual programming. A virtual is where we produce a fundraising so we don't have to go to the station, so every city gets the same fundraising. That did not go down well. People did not accept that message. As a result, when any part of the message was unacceptable, the whole message was thrown out because, again, the radical feminism had never been a part of mainstream culture or the subculture, but rather it was a counterculture. But I needed to have that happen in order to teach my publisher and Barbara and other people associated that you cannot just march in with any message and expect people to embrace it. The fact that you know something is true doesn't mean everyone else wants to know it. And that end had been part of the problem I'd seen over my entire life, which is one of the reasons I have kept away from joining a lot of the movements, the environmental movement, anti-war movements, the animal rights movements. I do not join these movements. I do support all of that, but I do it in my own way because I find many of the people who are heads of these movements are doing so because it serves their own political and emotional and psychological needs, and that whatever limitations they have as people, they bring that to their movements. And they can be extremely offensive and unrelenting and getting so much into the face of the people that they're trying to influence and assaulting their senses and sensibilities, that a person's not going to change because of this. So what a person actually desires, even idealistically, let's have a better world. Now let's go out there and take an older woman. And this actually happened. I'll never forget this, when Alex Hirschaff, who's a very conscientious person and has devoted his whole life, adult life, to helping animal rights, there was a demonstration down at Macy's. And he showed up with some of these firebrands, and a woman came out, an older woman. I'm going to guess she's in her 70s. It was in wintertime. And as she came out, a guy threw a bucket of paint on her, red paint. Now, this woman got hit in the head and on her hair and on her coat with red paint. And this young guy, you know, all the other activists were applauding. Yeah, you know, how many skins did it, you know, how many animals are dead because you had to wear that? And I walked over to the woman, and I stood between the woman and these people, and I said, if this was your mother or grandmother, is this how you would treat her? You have become as vile and as loathsome as the people that you are attacking. is like an anti-war movement person that I once marched with was talking about hiding bricks under his shirt so that when the fracas started, he could smash someone in the head with a brick. And I said, that's not what being against the war should be about. One form of violence against another form of violence is still violence. And I later told Alex, I said, Alex, you know, you planned this demonstration. I had you on my show. I helped support this. I'm here. But I'm here in a nonviolent way. I believe in nonviolent protest. And this woman's consciousness is not going to be raised. She's not going to go home and say, God, I'm glad someone tried this public humiliation to me and caught me by surprise. I needed to get emotionally sucker punched today. I'm so glad there are people in this world who are sensitive enough to those of us who are unconscious about these issues to insist that we grow up instantaneously to start earning our karma right now. And of course, when I pointed out to the people in the demonstration that they were all wearing leather shoes and leather belts and that some of them had, they were not vegetarians. I saw one of them eating candy bars, and I said, well, now, you're eating sugar. And in my book, sugar's just as bad as meat to your body, and also it's where we got slavery. And we wouldn't have had slavery in the United States had it not been for initially the sugar manufacturing for Europe long prior to America. I said, so do you consider it ethical to support something that supports sugar and therefore has supported slavery? And to this day, if you go to the Caribbean islands of Barbados, which I have, and Jamaica, where I have, you'll see that the best land was taken away from the natives who had sustainable agriculture and then treated with heavy pesticides for a cash crop for the rich elite, and the everyone else is poor. So do you say it's not right to wear a fur, which it is not right, but it's okay then to eat your sugar because you want your sugar fix or your caffeine? Do you know how many different problems you have with the coffee growers and the political issues in those countries where land has been taken over exclusively for production of coffee and the peasants are in effect working as slave labor? I said, do you really want people to change? What do you think the average American is going to think when he sees an older woman being drenched in red paint? But they didn't care. They were strident, self-righteous. They had their soapbox. And in so many occasions, people who are immersed in their own dynamic belief will not be open to anything else. And then I remember back to the 1930s, not that I was there, but historical referencing shows that you had a young elite group of exceptionally athletic and disciplined people. They were called Nazis. They were the young Hitler youth. Oh, you know, they'd go into bars and drag out Jews and beat them because they weren't as pure. And therefore, they had to show them. They had to close down their shops, make them wear yellow patches, designate them as Jews. They were excluded from all medical schools, teaching hospitals. But we never stop long enough to go to neutral, to examine whether or not our approach to a topic is reasonable or unreasonable. And that's why I do not belong to any group. I do not because I do not respect, nor do I trust the motives of the people who I personally met. And being in a public position, I have had an opportunity to meet people in a way that others have not. I've been able to see who they are as persons and where the theme of the effort itself can be completely legitimate. It doesn't mean the leaders are. And that's as true in feminism as it is in anti-war. But also, you cannot take a counterculture message into mainstream consciousness by galvanizing it. It has to be done very subtly. And it has to be done with great finesse. Much like cutting a diamond, and as risky as it is to get the right cut, now visualize it. You're in the backseat of a jalopy, and you're going across some potholes. You better know when to cut, when not, when to be patient, and keep your constant sense of focus. It is that kind of precision that makes a difference. And here I was on PBS making a message, but making a message that people could understand, that did not offend all their sensibilities. And therefore, it was reasonable to them. Most people, if you present a very reasonable argument, and you do so from their point of view, it gives them a chance to connect with it. If you try to get them to connect with your point of view, in other words, you're saying, come on out. Come out of that establishment. Come on down here. Get rid of your bias or your racism, your prejudice, or your politically limited views. Come on down here and join me. They have to first look around and say, what will I be sacrificing, surrendering if I go join you? And then they start realizing, my goodness, I would probably have to give up much of my identity of who I am, because my identity is also what I believe in. And if what I believe in is not a part of what you're about, then I'm going to be rejected. And all my comforts and all of my identity will also suffer. And maybe I just don't want that. Maybe I feel it's okay to stick around with the people and my society and church members and all the other things that are the boundaries of my life that give me my meaning and purpose for living, rather than just to make some radical shift that would take me to where you're at. Even if where you're at may be better on some level, it won't be better for me at this moment. Because you see, in any belief systems do not offer you a safe and effortless transition to a higher level. You're asked to achieve certain goals within the belief system to get to the levels that they allow. But that's what they allow. You can grow in your specialty to a certain degree, but you're still within what you were told are the limits of that. The limits of your power, the limits of your success, the limits of your money. And you still have to maintain your positions of responsibility and obedience. Well, if everyone else is eating meat, and everyone else is sick because of eating meat, it still isn't good enough to give up meat, because you have to give up the ritual of it. And rituals that have been given to us early in life that we have honored, those are very much grafted into us. It's much like peeling off someone's skin. It is a painful process. Now, if your doctor told you to give up meat because you have high blood pressure, then you can get away with doing it, because my doctor said I had to give up meat. Okay, I understand. But if you say, I heard Gary Noll on PBS and he said give up meat because it's bad for me, they'll go, well, why? Well, he said it's bad. Well, what's he know? Who's he? That's stupid. Is that one of those vegetarian nonsense? The message to change must always come from the main culture for it to be accepted. One of the reasons that I believe Bill Clinton was so successful, irrespective of the fact that he had one of the most reprehensibly amoral and immoral characters along with his wife, is because for a lot of baby boomers, they saw him as the ultimate insider, someone who could do what they wanted to do and had the fierce autonomy and independence to both schmooze on the outside to make everyone like you, good old boy attitude, which he had in spades, but also to see that his agenda was met and his friend's agenda. Well, that's pretty much what we want from people, providing that we like them. Well, one thing that we did, we liked him. So he was in the mainstream because he kept himself always centered around mainstream issues. The way he ate. Now, had he been a vegetarian, he'd have been thrown out of office a long time ago. Had he been a strong environmentalist, that would have caused him elections. But he was capable of talking out both sides of the mouth simultaneously, and he had multiple tongues. And he could tell everybody what they wanted to hear. And as long as you're able to do that, and that's a real mastery that it takes to do that, then you're going to minimize the people who will attack you. And when you do, you use that as a merit badge. And then other people rally behind you. Rarely have we seen someone, except for Kennedy, who was that good at doing that. But they're not counterculture. Maybe their sex life is. The swinging groups. And I've heard from firsthand accounts a lot of people about how many people in Washington at that time were into the swinging, where you don't get elected by saying, I promise to keep certain oaths of office, but in my personal life I intend to be very liberated sexually and to experiment, explore, share our fantasies with my wife. And people are going to say, what? Oh, we're not going to have a sexual deviant. And then suddenly you get all those religious groups and all those moral groups saying, this is counterculture. This is main culture. No, get out of here. We don't want you. So then suddenly a person says, a lot for defense. I'm going to give $12 billion more than what they even ask for. And I'm a Democrat doing this. Well, then who's going to attack you? The Republicans? No. The Democrats? Not anymore, because there are no Democrats anymore. We have either Republicans who are radical or Republicans who are moderate. And a moderate Republican and a Democrat, one can wear a hat in the morning and the other at night, because we didn't see the challenge. Because again, once you put all your faith and your identity behind your leader, you can't challenge that. You try to, and you take yourself from the main culture power to the subculture power. And no one from the counterculture was pointing out all the things that were going wrong. Counterpunch magazine, Mother Jones magazine, The Nation magazine. None of those have any power. They only have respect within the counterculture. They really don't make a difference otherwise. Just like the vegetarian who was trying to incite a woman not to wear a coat who threw paint on her, that's not going to allow anyone to grow, because the methods of change are not the ones that the person had been used to. Now, if someone of a position of power told this person, like their minister, rabbi, we should look within our religious text to see that we should have a reverence for life, and I would hope that you would embrace this as a part of your spiritual development, so that when you do come back to the synagogue or church, you will not find the need to wear an animal skin. We don't need it. We're evolved beyond wearing skins like our cavemen did. We don't need to clothe ourselves for this, and we cannot justify the style. But how you present a message and who does the presenting and what position of authority they have will make all the difference in the world, whether or not that message is ever applied or not. Think of it this way. Who wouldn't be respected today? Who wouldn't be invited into the mainstream religions today? Well, absolutely, Jesus Christ would be excluded from every main religion. Buddha, Muhammad. Do you think that Muhammad would identify with the concepts of Islamic fundamentalistic belief today? I really doubt it. If you go back and read the original text, think over the centuries, who would be excluded? Michelangelo? Absolutely. Leonardo da Vinci? Yes. Yeah. Because they were in their own time. Almost all of the people throughout history who proposed ideas that today we look upon as being reasonable or enlightened were not looked upon as reasonable or enlightened in their time. Only later did people appreciate what kind of ideas they had. Now, then do we assume that because those people who were martyred or criticized in their own time, like Spinoza, the great philosopher, will we be any more open to it today? No, if Spinoza was around today, the likelihood is he would be in the counterculture and therefore only have power like a Fritjof Capra or George Leonard or Michael Murphy, within the counterculture, not the main culture. Bill Moyers is able to go on television because Bill is in the subculture. even though he has brought some very important messages, really exemplary work. I respect his work. And in fact, his series with Joseph Campbell, I consider the best example of what public broadcasting from a informational and educational point of view can represent. I've watched that series over and over again. But there's nothing in Bill's basic shtick that is counterculture, even though many of the points are brought up by both Joseph Campbell and his discussions of Qigong and some of his ideological discussions. None of that is mainstream. It's all counterculture. So you can bring countercultural messages into the main culture, providing you do it without threatening everyone. And because you start off as a political, you know, person attached to John F. Kennedy, that establishes you. Just like Pierre Salinger. Pierre Salinger was an insider. He was a political insider. He was a reporter insider until he said that that TWA flight was down because of missiles. No matter what proof he had, overnight he was taken from main culture to counterculture. And there, nobody's going to believe anything he says. His word won't be taken as credible. So we have to understand how change occurs. Now, the big PBS stations, most of them, have been told by the guardians of the gate, you're not to have this kind of message on and again, period. So you're starting to see Washington, D.C., Boston, New York, no longer having my programs on. And they won't have them on. Not because of the reason they'll tell you, well, we've done this topic and it's kind of played out, or we're not into this kind of programming anymore. No one can argue with them. They have a right to play what they want to play. But the real truth of it is, because I've had program directors tell me, Gary, I'd love to have your programs on. I mean, they're the best that there's out there. And it's really helping people. But we've got a local member of our medical board, and they're very powerful. And I said, what do you mean by power? How are they powerful? Well, you know, they kind of an elite group on these PBS boards, and they sit here and they say, you know, this should happen and that shouldn't happen. This should get on the air and that shouldn't get on the air. If they don't want you on the air because what you're saying runs counter to their teachings, their medical teachings, then we have to pay attention to them because they're the ones who also get us our grants and they get us our, you know, our revenue flows. And we can't end up doing something that we'd like to do that could help our listeners, viewers, at the same time that cuts us off at the ankles. Now, the smaller PBS stations, they're kind of in just the opposite position. If you go into Heartland America and you go on to some small stations, if your message is at all not an orthodox message, I mean lickety-split, they turn off the sets. You can see it. I watched it. I watched in some cities like Chattanooga, where a very well-produced program by Wayne Dwyer tanked in prime time. I got in there early in the day, and it was on a Sunday, and from 4 o'clock until 8 o'clock, he got two pledges. I'm talking about $200. And I asked the program director, she said, it's such a good program. I said, you're liberal. You came here. You weren't born here. But if you put on Lawrence Welk, she's, oh, that goes through the roof. I said, yes, because Lawrence Welk is mainstream. And Wayne Dwyer's message that, you know, power is in you, you know, you can change. That's not what they're being taught their whole life, you know, out of the pulpit. I mean, they're taught, you know, that your number's up, it's in the book. You have to understand what a fundamentalistic upbringing does to people, even on a subconscious level. There's an automatic radar screen that can reject or accept things based upon how it's perceived and who's doing the talking. Wayne is not their minister. If it was their minister, the minister would not be able to give all this information. It would take a year or two of subtly bringing in these concepts, maybe one little concept at a time. Wayne is hitting you with the full frontal psychologically. And it's just turning people off like crazy. But if Wayne put that same message, on in Los Angeles or New York, it'd be better received because of having more people who are open to that kind of message, who are seeking that kind of message. And so when I saw how they were doing, I was about to put on a program called De-Stress Now. And I said, we can't put this on. She said, why? It's a great program. Are you kidding? We like this. I said, no. No, not here. Not this message. Let's put on nothing. Let me just go out there and talk. She said, well, you can't just go out there and talk for 4 hours. I said, sure I can. I said, if the object of the exercise is for me to raise your funds and not offend your audience, my documentary is going to offend too many people. It wasn't meant to offend anyone. But when you're talking about using meditation and deep breathing and guided visualization and journal writing, these are not messages that are taught in the mosques, the synagogues, and this is not an orthodox approach. I'm asking people to be responsible for their decisions. Orthodox religion takes a different view of that. You're responsible only to the degree that you must follow certain basic and fundamental and not challengeable rules of life. So I don't want to run up against that bustle. It'll be counterproductive to everything. So with 2 minutes left to go, they're sitting in the control room thinking, should we air De-Stress Now? And she comes back to me. She says, Gary, one last plead here. Everyone is stressed. Your message is the best message we've ever seen on de-stressing. I said, that's very possible. But think historically of all the people who've had a message on kindness and love your neighbor and do no harm and peaceful coexistence. And today, the way that message was presented has made that person a pariah. I said, there's no purpose in alienating an audience. Some people get a kick out of it. Some people look forward to it. Some people have an assault mechanism within their psyche. That's not what I'm here for. When I go on the radio in New York, I can present information that would be extremely difficult for some people to accept based upon choosing that I'm sharing it with an audience that already has accepted that if I'm going to turn on Gary's program, I may hear topics discussed in ways that my mainstream, you know, programs won't do. And so finally she agreed. So I went on and I asked people, what's important to you? Is disease important? Overcoming the pain of your disease? And if it is, call in, pledge to the station. And I will personally counsel you. Well, the phones just went crazy. The largest turnout in the history of the station. And I mean, not just the largest, it was like triple the previous best. Lemiz and Sinatra and Barbra Streisand, Riverdance, three tenors. And afterwards, it was about 11 o'clock at night, they were driving back to the hotel. The driver turned around and says, oh, you did pretty good tonight. I said, well, yes and no. I did good in that I tried to let people know that there are alternative and natural approaches to their illness. But I'm not going to change anyone's illness. I'll only help them as far as alleviating some of the pain and suffering. Because the real message is, what are you doing in your choices that are contributing to this pain, this disease process? That message they're not going to want to hear. And but overcoming the symptoms of it, that message they're at least open to hear. And so I called back and counseled about 63 people. They had slotted me to have $1,000 raised. And I went through that in the first 3 minutes. So I'm very sensitive to what forms can be used for which purposes and how to get that message within the mainstream consciousness if the object of the exercise is to have everyone have an equal opportunity to change if they chose to. Not just as people have already said, we don't have to be convinced of anything. We're already over here. So now there are about, I would say, 60 PBS stations around the country, small to medium size, and a few large ones, that still hold the doors open because they don't have medical advisors and they have not succumbed to pressure, even though in some cases they have been threatened with, you know, all kinds of little machinations behind the scenes. So the message is getting out for change. But the harder messages, like my Gulf War Syndrome special, AIDS special, which I'm producing right now, it'll be done. I'm going to show it, by the way, out in Los Angeles and in New York and Washington, some of the major cities, Detroit. I'm going to take this around. It'll be ready in about 8 weeks. I'm going to have a press conference and premiere in different cities. Hardest hitting documentary I've ever done. Taking me all over the world. 37 countries filming it over 3 years. Right down to the final post-editing. But even in how we do that message, I had a choice in if I have one of two people to make a statement, I always selected the person who was inside the main scientific culture to make the statement. Because then it's more difficult for that person's, let's say, peers to automatically reject it as being, oh, there's no credibility in that person. And no, this person's a Nobel Prize winner. He's your colleague. Oh, what's he saying? He's saying that everything that you know about AIDS is wrong. Really? Couldn't be. No, there are six other Nobel Prize winners in virology and molecular biology who agree with him. They're saying it too. In fact, there's 443 scientists, orthodox guys, Harvard, Yale, Columbia, Stanford. They're saying the same thing. They're all part of deconstructing this myth. So how you go about structuring an argument can frequently determine whether or not there's ever going to be anyone moved or any change occur because of it. Let's go now to some of the issues I feel are important that we understand. This comes from Carol Koff. Most of the sub-cabinet and the White House appointees were virtually unknown to the public and probably will remain unknown throughout their terms. But they have extraordinary influence, and in some cases, foes fear them more than cabinet officers. Case in point is John D. Graham, named the head of the little-known Office of Information and Regulatory Affairs, which vets all significant or controversial regulations. Graham is founder of the Harvard Center for Risk Analysis. Now, that's an interesting title, the Harvard, meaning Harvard University, Center for Risk Analysis. Well, you'd think that's something good. And it's funded by more than 100 large corporations and trade groups, including Dow Chemical, 3M, DuPont, Monsanto, Exxon, and American Petroleum Institute. It is the leading proponent of, quote, comparative risk analysis, unquote, to balance the needs for regulations against the risk of the event. And he was prominent in the 1995 regulatory reform battles. Quote, John Graham has a long history of opposing even the most broadly accepted public health protection measures, including the measures to reduce drinking water contamination, unquote. That's according to Greg Whetstone, spokesman for the National Resource Defense Council, an environmental group. Graham's nomination, quote, is arguably the single sharpest stick in the eye of the public interest community yet, unquote. Now, according to the Washington Post Company, follow the money. This is where the Harvard Center for Risk Assessment Analysis gets its funding. It doesn't prove anything, but just makes you go, The Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, American Crop Protection Association, the ones that use pesticides and want to protect it, American Industrial Health Council, Andrew Mellon Foundation, the Brookings Institute, California Avocado Commission, Chemical Manufacturers Association, the Chlorine Chemistry Council, there's your water pollution, the Health and Environmental Science Group, that's a pro-industry group, National Association of Home Builders, National Institutes of Justice, Pfizer, Center for Disease Control, U.S. Department of Agriculture, Department of Energy, Department of Health and Human Services, Department of Transportation. These are all people who give this foundation money. And Monsanto Company, Mobil Foundation, Merck, Louisiana Chemical Association, Kraft Foods, Johnson & Johnson, International Paper, Hoffman LaRoche, Hoist, the Grocers Manufacturers of America, Goodyear Tire and Rubber Company, Alcoa. That's just some of the people. But at no time was this brought up by anyone in the media. Now there's a person who's now in place. So now here's the question. And this is where I'll show you how things tie together when you step back so you can look at how they are interconnected. If you expect that there will be a movement to restrict or study the effects of pesticides on our health, it's not going to happen. If there's anything in the environment that is shown now to cause a cancer or any mutagenic effect, it's going to be downplayed.